Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding is now in session.
You may be seated. The first case for this morning is Ibrahim Nasser Ibrahim versus South Dakota Department of Public Safety. The appellant Department of Public Safety is present through attorney Edward Haruska, and Mr. Ibrahim is present, represented through counsel. Mr. Ibrahim is not present, but represented through counsel Jason Adams, who is present this morning. Each side will have 20 minutes to present your initial arguments, and then Mr. Haruska, you'll have 10-minute rebuttal at the conclusion. The orange light will come on at 2 minutes to give you a warning when your time is almost expired. With that, Mr. Haruska, you may proceed with your opening argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, counselor. Good morning, everyone. My name is Edward Haruska. I'm here on behalf of the state of South Dakota, the Department of Public Safety. On behalf of the department, we are requesting that this court reverse the memorandum opinion and order of the circuit court issued in this matter and remand the decision with instructions for implementation to reinstitute the department's final decision in this matter, disqualifying Mr. Ibrahim's commercial driving privileges for a period of not less than 1 year. We're requesting this relief for three different bases. First, that the circuit court ignored the prudential rules of civil appellate procedure, overriding the presentation of the parties and sua sponte interjecting a preferred theory of the case. Second, that if this court determines it wants to reach the void for vagueness analysis as performed by the circuit court, that the circuit court committed error in determining that SDCL 3212A36 sub 4 was impermissibly vague. And the third reason, that it should be remanded with instructions to reinstitute the department's final decision in this matter, is that there were sufficient facts within the evidence which could allow the department to adopt the hearing examiner's proposed decision in this matter.
Mr. Haruska, I'm sorry, Mr. Haruska, your first argument ignored prudential rules. That doesn't resolve the sufficiency of the evidence argument, is that correct?
That is correct, Chief Justice. And I believe that the remedy as required by the United States Supreme Court would be to vacate the decision of the circuit court, remand for consideration based on the arguments of the parties at the intermediate appellate level at the circuit court in this matter.
Counsel, why wasn't a transcript prepared at the administrative level?
The department's position is that sufficient evidence was within the settled record, which could substantiate the findings of fact as found by the hearing examiner. Specifically, Justice Kern would direct the court's attention to, I believe it is settled record 33, which is the abstract of the operating record for Mr. Ibrahim. Now, if I may elaborate a little bit, Justice Kern, the department's abstract of operating record, the department doesn't concern itself with somebody walking down the street, nor does it concern itself with somebody riding a bicycle. This is for people who have committed violations of the rules of the road in operating vehicles. That abstract at settled record 33 indicates the felony designation of the violation he committed while he was operating a vehicle, the citation date, the conviction date, and the docketing number, the criminal docketing number arising out of Minnehaha County.
Did anyone take judicial notice of the underlying criminal file, meaning the administrative judge, the circuit court judge?
Yes, Justice Kern. Circuit Court Judge Hoffman took judicial notice of the underlying State versus Ibrahim criminal file. If memory serves, I believe there were seven different violations, and the initial violation was a non-illuminated tail license plate, I believe, if memory serves.
Did the hearing examiner also take judicial notice of the underlying criminal file?
No, the hearing examiner did not, to my recollection, Justice Devaney.
Can you explain that further, or was the officer not asked to do that?
The hearing examiner was not asked to do that, but the settled record put before the hearing examiner did have that abstract of operating, which indicated the violations and conviction dates within there.
Did it specify? It looked like in the notice it just referred to a felony while operating a vehicle. Did it give any more specificity to what the offense was?
The notification did not, and the abstract and the what I would call the violation that is notified to the Department of Public Safety indicates a felony conviction occurring while operating a vehicle. And so because it was a suspended imposition of sentence, I don't believe that that notification gave any more specificity than what it was, which was simply that he was convicted of a felony while operating that motor vehicle.
The hearing officer found there was marijuana in the vehicle. That was one of the hearing officer's findings. Where did that finding or what evidence supported that finding?
I believe that was the testimony of Mr. Ibrahim at the hearing, administrative hearing itself, Chief Justice.
Mr. Bruska, if we, and I agree with you that the rules that are stated in the Sinanang Smith case are prudential. I had that same thought. If they apply, it seems as though two questions. One, at the end of the opinion, it seems as though the court in that case applies sort of an extraordinary circumstances test. These are the rules. This is the general rule. And we'll adhere to them or hold lower courts to adhere to them in the absence of extraordinary circumstances. Do you agree with that formulation of the rules?
I do.
Secondly, if that's right, what is our standard of review? Justice Thomas's concurring opinion mentions in passing an exercise of the court's discretion, and it does seem as though, as you think about it, some degree of deference might be appropriate, but maybe not. And I'll hear from Mr. Adams as well, but what standard would we apply if those rules apply, as you suggest?
And Justice Salter, I would like to just elaborate on parts of your questions, if I may.
There's a lot in there, I'm sorry.
If they apply, I do believe they do. The standard of review, I believe, was noted by Justice Ginsburg as an abuse of discretion, which would be outside the permissible range of choices that the circuit court, as an intermediate court, had in front of it. The circuit court here, that's a statutorily controlled question, Justice Salter, which is 126.36. It's the same standard of review that this court has, which is a range of choices allowed by statute. The range of choices is not to interject preferred theories of the case or override the party's presentations. And so I do think there is that extraordinary circumstances here where the court could vacate and remand based on the party's presentation.
You may have this set of rules existing in every circuit court of appeals now, certainly in the federal system. It may exist in all 50 states. So maybe those rules aren't in and of themselves all that remarkable. They may seem as practical as they are legal, but it seems like you'd have fact-bound results all over. Courts testing, if in fact it's an extraordinary circumstances test, testing the circumstance of each case to see if it gets there or doesn't get there. As it relates to this case, however, what's extraordinary about this case, and in that regard, does it matter that Mr. Ibrahim seemingly, as Justice Ginsburg noted, rode the argument and the theory almost in contravention, not impermissibly perhaps, but almost in contravention or different from the argument that they had at an earlier point? Does that bear on the extraordinary circumstances in any way, shape, or form?
I think it does, Justice Salter. The extraordinary circumstances here, to my mind, bear some of a factual recitation, but that is this idea that SDCL 3212A36 sub 4 is impermissibly vague was never raised at the trial level, i.e. the OHE's administrative hearing, really wasn't raised at the intermediate appeal level either until the circuit court's interjection of a preferred theory of the case. So I do think when you have those two different appellate steps being worked through, the trial step and then the appellate step being worked through, which you have the extraordinary circumstances of a circuit court varying and straying from the prudential rules of appellate practice, I would urge this court, frankly, to expand upon the Erickson versus DPS concurrence. We're well aware of that, and Justice Kern's concurrence with retired Justice Wilbur's reminds circuit courts to address the matters brought up before it, and I believe in the concurrence stated that they would not have gotten to those issues addressed by the court in that matter because they were outside of the scope of the appeal at the intermediate level.
Well, doesn't that present a little bit of an issue too? I assume there was no constitutional issue presented to the department.
It was not, Chief Justice.
And so the first time that comes up is in front of the circuit court. Then both parties, he presents two questions, one of those being the constitutional question. Both sides brief it. There's no objection to that process or anything like that. Does that impact how we view this prudential document, doctrine that you're talking about?
To answer your question, no, I don't think it does, Chief Justice, and here's why. The cases and authority that have been provided through the briefings are in opposite to the question here today, which is to say that there is a failure to object question, I think. The cases at the trial level is where these matters were brought up and parties failed to object. Now, the trial level here is in front of the hearing examiner. This was never brought up there. It really wasn't brought up in the first set of briefs before the circuit court either. Practically speaking, the circuit court said, go answer these questions, to which I said, yes, I'll adhere to what the circuit court would want me to do. But an objection from a functional standpoint would look no different than what I had already provided the circuit court, which is its standard of review at 126.36, and the consideration that findings and conclusions of law are granted at an intermediate appellate level. So to my mind, the circuit court had all the information it needed to perform a succinct review of the record and decided not to, or decided to do otherwise, as it would be. Does that answer your question, Chief Justice?
Yes, thank you.
I believe that we've addressed at least sub one of the department's positions. I would address the second part, which is if this court determines it wants to reach the void for vagueness question, I believe that there has been an error of law in the circuit court's interpretation of the vagueness doctrine. The standard of review for this court is straightforward. This court owes no deference to the circuit court's conclusions. The statute at issue is SDCL 3212A36 sub 4. The department argues now, as then, that this requires a straightforward interpretation of the statute, and the plain language requires a disqualification of 1 year for any person who has been convicted of using a vehicle and committing a felony, and committing any felony, to use the precise language of the statute. The circuit court's analysis begins to redraft and cut away at the same time the plain language of the statute. Now, the statute requires any felony. That is a broad class without limitation. Now, there is one exception to that general rule within the statute, which is to say if somebody uses a vehicle in the manufacturing, distribution, possession of narcotics, it is not just a one-year disqualification, but a lifetime ban. But that lifetime ban is the exception to the any felony language. And so, while I know that there's been some considerations of, well, if a person is failing to register or committing insider trading while he's operating a car, is that a felony within the scope of the statute? The answer to that question, in my mind, is yes. Any felony is without limitation. And it's precisely because the right, the privilege to drive on the roads in the state of South Dakota is a limited one, and a person must conform to the law. CDL drivers have a heightened licensure. And when they decide to make violations when they're operating any vehicle, they're required to undergo a disqualification for a period of 1 year.
How central, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Ruska, but how central to our job here is it that we reach the void for vagueness determination? Which is to say, I suppose, how central really was it to what the circuit court decided? It seems like there's one way you can read Judge Hoffman's opinion to essentially just say, look, I mean, there's no proof of use. There's no proof of this active sort of implementation or using the car as an instrument of the offense. And if that's the case, maybe it's really just a question of statutory construction. We have to figure out what use means. And do we really even have to get to a question about vagueness?
Well, I think the vagueness analysis that the circuit court performed also dovetailed into his memorandum opinion order reversing the department's final decision, because to my mind, the circuit court said if this statute is impermissibly vague, it cannot form a basis for a disqualification. So I think that this court, if it decides to move past the prudential rules argument and undertake the void for vagueness analysis, it must look at the statute itself and determine whether that statute is impermissibly vague.
Either way, don't you think that at the heart of the merits portion of this appeal, we have to construe using in this case, but use, yes?
I believe so, Justice Alter. And
Go ahead.
No, please. Excuse me.
No, no, I want to hear your answer. Forgive me.
Well, to the point that I would make is a reference back to the settled record as in front of the OHE and the findings of fact 3 through 5 that indicated the abstract of operating. That is use. Those things are criminal infractions indicating use of a vehicle. That, again, the circuit court had said something to the effect of, well, he'd have been just as guilty if he was walking down the street committing this felony. It wouldn't have shown up in his abstract of operating record if he was walking along. It only shows up when he's driving.
Different statute, surely, but there are some criminal statutes out there. And the one that comes to mind is the federal one that prohibits use of a gun, use of a firearm in relation to certain offenses, like drug trafficking offenses, things like that. And the Supreme Court of the United States has at various times and in several decisions said that that kind of use isn't just sort of having a gun. You need to use the gun in some way. You have to actively kind of use it as a part of committing the offense. And I think there's reasons why that might be different here or not. And I know it's not in the briefs, but I wondered if maybe that wasn't what the circuit court judge was driving at here. What are your thoughts?
Well, and I think that's akin to the instrumentality requirement that the circuit court has placed on the statute in part of his memorandum opinion and order. And the problem that I have with that type of interpretation is that begins to constrain what is a general statute of applicability into a very narrow captured statute of, I believe the examples were, well, it can't be hit and run because that's under a different subpart, but a getaway driver eluding the police. And that's just not the plain language of the statute, Justice Salter.
And you're relying upon that any felony text, which I don't want to make your argument for you, but your thought would be that if it were otherwise, it would enumerate felonies, maybe like the statute I just told you about.
Yes, and the reason I say that is because there are enumerated felonies earlier on in the same statute. So the legislature could have enumerated and limited that statute if it wanted to. It kept the broad language. The first subpart is DUIs. The second subpart is CDL DUIs. The third subpart is felony hit and run. So, I mean, there's the ability to constrain that. And I would also, not to keep going, but there is an exception within the statute where they specifically accept out a lifetime ban within the statute itself. So it gives you the general class, and then it gives you the general lifetime ban for the specific crime and felony.
How do you reconcile the difference? And even in you taking the argument that any felony opens up a broad category of potential felonies, and it's not just the term use, it's use in the commission of a felony. So I think we have to look at the whole phrase. How do you see a distinction between that phrase and the one in 3212.52.3, which is instead written as you're convicted of a drug offense while in a vehicle? So that's kind of the, we have to address that.
Understood, Justice Devaney, I don't want to seem glib about it, but my first analysis on that question is that's dealing with driver's licenses. That specifically 3212 is just for general driver's licenses, and 3212A is specific to CDL holders specifically. So I think that the specific language of the statute should be construed and not the general language of the driver's licensing. But to your point, I think the language of using the non-commercial or commercial motor vehicle in the commission of any felony is simply to say operating, using it during the commission of any felony, which happened here. Mr. Ibrahim had possession of felony levels of marijuana, and he was using a motor vehicle.
Well, then there's the separate question of whether a vehicle is being used to possess a quantity of drugs while the vehicle is being operated. But it's the earlier question part. That still seems to presume that the vehicle somehow has to be used to commit the crime in the commission of the felony.
And Justice Devaney, the department's position is that that's not the language or the plain language of the statute, which says that the operating a non-commercial motor vehicle in the commission of any felony doesn't limit it to only those that have the felony as part and parcel, or excuse me, the vehicle as part and parcel of the felony itself. And let me elaborate a little bit further, if I may. If that were the case, then what's the point of 3212A, 36 sub 3 that has felony hit and run? Why delineate that out if that could just be encompassed within subpart 4 itself?
Well, you know, and I don't know why it was drafted that way. I looked at some of the prior cases. It appears this was based upon federal regulation, the Federal Motor Vehicle Traffic Safety Act and a CFR, which the equivalent provision in the federal regs is somewhat similar, but it actually is perhaps even more direct, and it says it's using the vehicle to commit a felony, is the way the federal regulation reads. But even if we apply that, if we assume that does mean the vehicle has to be part of the commission of, in this case, I assume it's your position, but tell me if otherwise, even if we apply that, using a vehicle could encompass possessing drugs in the vehicle while you're operating it.
Yes, it could, Justice Devaney. And I think that's what was found here, is that he was in possession of marijuana at felony levels while he was operating a vehicle. I see my time is about up. With that, I'll thank the court and stand by for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Adams, you may proceed with your argument at this time.
May it please the court, counsel. I guess I'd like to start by thanking the court to allow me to come up and make this argument in front of your honors today. As the court knows, my client is a holder of a commercial driver's license. That is his livelihood. That is how he makes his living. And because of the department's ruling almost 3 years after he was stopped in this matter, he was prevented from employment in that profession for a year.
What's the status of his license? I know the after it went through the hearing, it was revoked, and the department initially gave notice of the revocation. Was that period stayed, and has any of the revocation or disqualification period happened, or what's the status of this?
Unfortunately, because my client was pro se at the time, Justice Jensen, my client did not request a stay as required within the, I believe it was 10 days. He did not request that stay, so his revocation did run. So there's some question as to whether or not this issue is moot.
Well, that's what I'm getting at, is the year has expired, right?
That's correct. And I did talk to my client about that, and he wanted to proceed with this appeal because it's affecting his ability to get future employment, because this is a black mark on his driver's history. He has specifically been denied employment.
Has he gotten his CDL back?
He has, yes. So I know one of the issues that the department has brought up is that this was not properly appealed. The issue was not properly appealed. I will concede that prior counsel, nor my client, nor myself, specifically gave the notice the statute requires to the Attorney General's office. But the fact of the matter is the Attorney General's office participated in this case from the beginning. They participated in front of the administrative law judge. They have participated in front of the circuit court, and they certainly are participating here. The department hasn't really explained how they have been prejudiced by that failure to give that proper notification. Judge Hoffman specifically asked the two of us to brief these two issues. He did so sua sponte. And I believe that he has the ability to do that because it is a constitutional issue. And this court certainly has jurisdiction to review Judge Hoffman's request to do so. And I understand that there's a higher burden when the appeal is not sought properly, but it's not like it was brought up for the first time on appeal without the Attorney General's participation. The Kern case cited by the department differs from this case because in Kern, it was brought up for the first time in the Supreme Court. The Attorney General did not have notice in that case. They did have actual notice in this case because they participated. I believe that the department's failure to object is also something that they've tried to get around And the fact of the matter is, their failure to object precludes them from now objecting to this court. And in Erickson, which is cited by them throughout their brief, they did object to the circuit court's request of that question. And they're on notice. They did not do that here in this case. So the department's failure to object, I believe, precludes them from making that argument that it's not properly before this court. Furthermore, I don't know factually what would be different had they been given the proper notification at the administrative law judge level. This court reviews constitutional issues de novo. So whether it was an administrative law judge making that determination or the circuit court, this court would have the ability to review that anyway. Unfortunately, my client did not request the transcript of that hearing within the prescribed time. I was retained subsequent to the time frame expiring, so I was not able to get a copy of that transcript. The department also had the ability.
I'm sorry to interrupt, if I could. I want to just clarify your argument before I lose my train of thought here. So I understand your waiver argument, no objection. But does that apply to just the failure to give the Attorney General notice? Or does that also apply to the error identified by the department as the claim that the judge shouldn't have acted on his own? Does that waiver argument apply to both the lack of notice and the argument that the judge shouldn't have acted on his own?
I believe the waiver argument applies to the fact that the judge shouldn't have requested those issues to be briefed on its own. Okay. As it pertains to the notice, I believe that this court still has jurisdiction because it's a constitutional issue, and the Attorney General was on notice. They had the opportunity to participate and fully brief this matter not once, but twice.
If it's not a waiver argument, and let's just talk about the idea that if it's not, just for our discussion, do the rules that are set out in the brief from the Senator Nang Smith case, and we have some similar language about restraint and acting on a court's own initiative, do those apply here, and do you have a quarrel with that? If they apply, what makes this case the kind of case where a judge should be able to act on his or her own?
I believe that the Sinning Smith case is distinguishable from the current case. First, it's a federal immigration case. Second, the Ninth Circuit in that case did something truly extraordinary. They asked three amici, to brief the issue rather than the parties that were involved in the case. And I think it was Justice Ginsburg's comment that was beyond the pale. And I think that's clearly distinguishable from this case where Circuit Court on an administrative appeal requested the parties to brief not only a constitutional issue but a statutory construction issue. Moving on, I believe that the next argument that the department relies on is their void for vagueness argument. And I believe it was Justice Salter brought up the fact that it may be a statutory construction argument. And this was fully set forth in the briefing, but I do believe that had the legislature intended the department's definition of this statute, that they would have clearly have said so. They did that in 3212.52.3. They did that in the felony firearm statute. But they didn't use that exact language in 3212A-36 sub 4.
So, am I understanding your argument to be that, kind of like the example I was using, and it doesn't have to be exactly this way, but the use under that federal statute I was talking about means active employment of a firearm in connection with or in relation to the commission of an enumerated offense, including a drug trafficking offense. Not this statute, not this case. But it does seem like that kind of is similar to the concept that the circuit court was kind of discussing. Do you
think that is true, or maybe not?
I agree, and I think the circuit court relied on, I believe it was one Red Pontiac. It was a forfeiture case, and in that case, which has now been changed by statute, but the reasoning is still sound in that Justice, I believe it was Justice Woolman at the time, made the comment that the possession of marijuana in that case wasn't used. And the legislature subsequently amended the statute to give it the meaning that Justice Woolman addressed in that case.
So if you look at that then as either active employment or as an implement of the offense or however we want to talk about that, what would be a way that a car could be used in the possession of any kind of contraband? I mean, how could a car be used? It's a seemingly kind of a passive offense. Maybe your answer is you don't think it can be. I don't know.
I would agree with that. You know, obviously, if you're distributing or intending to distribute.
Which is a different offense. So just a possession of contraband at a felony grade level. How would a car be used that way?
To store it.
And that differs from possessing it?
Yes. You know, let's say that somebody has...
Offense, I don't mean to interrupt you, but is there an offense that makes it a felony to store a felony-grade quantity of, in this case, marijuana? Or is it simply just a possession, you know, the ability to control it? Kind of, isn't that the offense?
Obviously, knowledge would be an element involved in that either way, Your Honor. But if a person... Let's say they had a junkyard and they were using some of their vehicles to store their contraband in. That's a situation that I can think of to answer that question. But the fact of the matter is the legislature wasn't clear in how they worded the statute. And I believe that the way it's worded, especially when it starts off with upon first conviction, it makes it seem like there is a crime of a felony use of a vehicle, and there is no such crime in our code. That was thoroughly discussed in the briefing, and that's something that Judge Hoffman, the circuit court, relied upon in determining that the statute as written does not make sense, and that's why he looked at other statutes and determined that the legislature knows how to word these statutes, and they didn't do that in this case.
From what you've just said, Mr. Adams, it sounds to me like you are relying primarily then on the vagueness challenge as opposed to the application of the definition of using the vehicle in the commission of a felony to apply to this case.
I understand.
I mean, that's...
And I would say it's both because there are no facts in the record to support the fact that my client was using a motor vehicle. I know the department relies on some testimony that my client had given, but that's not in the record. And
so if the hearing officer made a finding of fact based upon what was presented at the hearing, and now we don't have a transcript, do we not have to give a presumption of correctness to that finding?
I think both parties had an obligation, especially when there's a pro se litigant, to request a transcript in this matter. I know the burden is higher for the appellant, but when you have a pro se litigant, like my client was in this case, I think the courts in the past have given due deference to that. I know that's something that Justice Ginsburg mentioned in the Singson Smith's case, and where there have been exceptions made, extraordinary circumstances exist.
Criminal cases, I think she mentioned, but in any event.
That's true. And this is, while it's not a criminal case, this is a collateral consequence of a criminal case. So I think that does have some bearing on the underlying case. I think it's also troubling that the department, for the second time, since the Erickson case at least, didn't put anything in the record regarding the underlying criminal conviction. They put in no pleadings of what the client was charged with. They put in no judgment of conviction. They put in no suspended imposition of sentence. That was remedied when the circuit court took judicial notice of the criminal record, but the department bears some responsibility in setting forth the record themselves, and that was their failure there.
Can the circuit court expand the record by taking judicial notice of documents that were not before the administrative judge?
And I know that's something that was brought up in the Erickson case. In reviewing the statute this morning, I believe that the circuit court can do that, and I'll concede that I waived that argument by not objecting to it when the circuit court told us that it was going to do that, much like the department waived their argument when they didn't object to the circuit court requesting us to brief those two additional issues.
I want to talk about the sufficiency of the evidence argument, because Judge Hoffman seemed to rest maybe part of his decision on that. And assume for a minute, I know you may not agree with this, but let's assume that the statute is triggered, the disqualification is triggered based upon felony possession of marijuana in a vehicle. Just make that assumption, whether you agree with that or not. If that's what the statute says, was the evidence sufficient in this case in your view to support disqualification, or what more would be needed based on your view of the record?
In the record that the circuit court had available to him, no, I don't believe that it was. And I think the thing that you would need is documentation indicating that this occurred in a motor vehicle. The state, in their criminal prosecution, had the opportunity to put that language on the pleadings, and the circuit court found that that was not done in this case. There's no mention of motor vehicle in the criminal record.
So your view is, notwithstanding any testimony that may have been offered in front of the department, that there was a felony level of marijuana in the vehicle as Mr. Ibrahim was driving, that's not sufficient unless you've got it noted in the conviction, judgment of conviction, that this occurred in a motor vehicle?
There needs to be that finding, I believe, and I believe the case is Apprendi. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case that requires a specific finding. That, again, is a criminal case. I believe that talked about the career offender statutes, but there needs to be a finding, whether it be by the court or by the jury, that my client was using a motor vehicle, and that's not in the record.
Well, Apprendi is a Sixth Amendment right to jury trial case, says that all the facts that drive the statutory maximum sentence have to be proven to a jury. So it involves sentence, you know, the sentence you can impose. But I don't know that this really applies to that.
I believe that there needs to be a finding, though, that he was in using a motor vehicle. So,
would it have mattered had the Office of Hearing Examiner's findings specifically indicated that there was testimony? And not that we have that here necessarily, but just thinking about how other ways of developing the record.
I mean, that would be a finding of fact by the hearing examiner, but I think you still need to allow the circuit court to be able to review that finding subsequent to that conclusion necessarily. So I think you'd need more, whether it's the transcript, whether it's testimony of a witness, or whether it's a document that talks about him being in vehicle.
And here the circuit court didn't have that because there was no transcript.
That's correct.
Mr. Adams, is this really a question, and I'm not saying it is, you know, ambiguous, but is it a question of vagueness, or maybe at most ambiguity in determining the text of the statute? One. Two, I'll do what I did to Mr. Ruska and line up a couple questions. What do you do with that text, any felony? So earlier you had a construction of the statute that seemed to suggest that your view, and I know this was expressed by the circuit court as well, is that this seems to relate to or suggest anyway specific felonies that may not really exist that involve using the vehicle as a part of the commission of a crime.
Is that ambiguous or is that vague? One. Two, what do you do with any felony in that text?
I believe it's certainly ambiguous, Justice Salter, because...
That wouldn't be a constitutional deficiency, though. We just use rules of statutory construction and kind of try to figure out what it meant.
Correct. And it doesn't make sense that the legislature would list every felony that they thought applied, and this is their attempt at a catch-all provision. Their intent is also that it is being used in the commission of that felony, of any felony. So that's why the two hypotheticals I put in my brief and that the department hasn't yet answered is somebody that failures to register as a sex offender, is that individual guilty of, if he's a CDL holder, which many sex offenders are because it's one of the few jobs that they can use, is he then guilty because he failed to register as a sex offender while driving a motor vehicle?
But don't we have to view the question before us now in the context of the facts that are alleged in this case? Even a vagueness challenge, don't we look as it applied to the facts in this case?
The case law does indicate that on a vagueness challenge that you are to apply it to the facts of this case. But when you're looking at an ambiguity argument, I don't know that's necessarily the case. And
your time is up, so you can wrap up your answer if you have anything else you need to answer Justice Devaney's question.
Thank you. I would just rely on my briefing and thank you again for the opportunity.
All right. Mr. Ruska, you may proceed with your reply. Rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Chief Justice Jensen. I wanted to take a moment just to expound on some questions that I heard the court address to counsel. Beginning with the question of mootness, I do think that this is, as we mentioned, Mr. Ibrahim has now retained his CDL. However, the exception to the mootness doctrine would be a repetitive event that's evading review. And I think by, at least on some of these levels, you have that. Certainly the idea of expanding the scope of prudential appellate practice, this has been before this court a number of times. I think this is an opportunity to address that matter, and it would evade review if the court were to dismiss it on mootness. In terms of documentary evidence, and I'm hopping around a little bit here, but I again think that when there's questions about how did the hearing examiner arrive at the facts that it did, I really want to emphasize that the court should look at settled record 33 when it talks about the abstract of operating record, driver history, felony committed in a vehicle by a CDL holder, the violation date, the conviction date, the location, and the criminal docketing number. This was entered into the record and before the hearing examiner. Now, the standard of review on this matter is deference to the findings and the conclusions draw at the hearing examiner level and the departmental level. And so when you have hard documents that were entered into the record that support the findings, I believe that the deferential view is to allow the hearing examiner made the correct conclusions based on the documents and testimony provided.
Who prepares those abstracts?
They are cataloged by the Department of Public Safety, Justice Devaney.
Was there any information in the record that explained how that information and from what source, how that information ends up in the abstract?
And my understanding is that when UJS goes through the conviction dates, these are transmitted over to the Department of Public Safety through interagency communications and kept track of as licensed individuals go through the process. And this may be for renewing his commercial driver's license or otherwise in the future, so that these violations would appear as he comes forward to do the licensing.
Does the abstract have the criminal file number?
It does. It does, Your Honor.
You said that already. Thank you.
I may have missed it, Mr. Huska, but I know when you had mentioned, and I'd seen somewhere else that Mr. Ibrahim testified, And I know it's not really fair to anyone to say who said what because we don't have a record, so I won't do that. But could you give me a sense at least of, I mean, it sounds like there was live testimony. Was there one, two witnesses, maybe at least who they were? I'm just kind of curious.
Justice Salter, I attended the hearing. Mr. Ibrahim attended with his attorney at the time. I believe it was, I don't recall her name. I think maybe Eggert comes to mind.
Yes, Eggert.
And the department had a witness, which would have been Carrie Schrank, who administered and cataloged the documents for the hearing itself.
Oh, I did see that. Okay. So those two testified?
Yes, yes, they did, Your Honor. I would point to the Klutzman case for the holding that the appellant is required to protect or provide any countervailing facts on appeal. In this case, the appellant is Mr. Ibrahim at the circuit court level, at the intermediate court level. By statute, he's required to order a transcript, and failure to do so constitutes a waiver. Now, a number of people said he's pro se. He was represented by an attorney at the hearing examiner level, and I did not receive a withdrawal. It appears that his documents provided at the circuit court looked to be a pro se filing, and then he was represented by counsel. But at no time were there motions made saying, let's get a transcript, notwithstanding Mr. Ibrahim's failure to do so as a pro se litigant. The department felt that this settled record 33 in the abstract has enough documentary evidence to show that the findings were not based on speculation or conjecture, but rather criminal violations and criminal convictions. One thing I'd take a moment to address is a question presented by Justice Salter, and that is in addressing U.S. versus Sinang Smith. That case was not addressed by Appley in the briefs, and this is the first time I've heard him address that case here today, which is to say I believe that he's waived it by failing to address it in the briefs itself. But to get to the point of the question, I believe that Justice Ginsburg's unanimous opinion wasn't how the Ninth Circuit went outside the scope of the rules of appellate procedure, but the fact that they did so and brought forth arguments neither presented by the parties. Whether they asked 3 or 15 people to brief it as amici is, I don't think, dispositive of the issues, that they overrode the party's presentation and went outside the scope of the rules of prudential appellate procedure.
Mr. Huska, in these types of hearings that are held before the hearing examiners, is it your understanding that at present this is the routine method of presenting the evidence of conviction, the abstract, as opposed to a certified judgment?
And I think in this matter, Justice Meyer, and it would be because Mr. Ibrahim was granted a suspended imposition of sentence. And so we'd have to probably apply to get around the sealing of that document. But this abstract, I believe, is the common practice for the departments in presenting evidence of criminal convictions and violations as it relates to somebody operating a motor vehicle.
Thank you.
One thing as a note, as an aside, the notification issues regarding the Attorney General's office, I just want to reiterate that it's not so much the Attorney General's have been prejudiced, but just to underscore the issue that this was never brought forth until the Circuit Court decided to do it as an intermediate appellate court. Typically in these cases, if there are constitutional challenges, as this court knows, you'll see a 321 notice come down saying we're challenging the constitutionality of the statute. That didn't happen here, and I only bring that forward to underscore the issue that this matter just wasn't raised at any level until the intermediate appellate court chose to. I know I have some time remaining, but I'm reminded of something Chief Justice Gilbertson once said, which is no one is penalized for finishing early. So I'll thank the court for its time. Yeah. Have a good day.
Thank you, counsel. And I want to express my thanks to both attorneys for your oral arguments this morning. The case will be submitted. And we're in recess, and this will actually conclude our oral arguments for the January term.